Well, good morning, faithful friends. You set your clocks correctly, or at least your phone did the work for you. Good morning, friends. Delighted to be with you again. I think for the recording, I'm supposed to say I'm Eric Barreto. I teach at the seminary. We've been doing this for a few weeks. I was very sad to miss you all last week, but glad to be back. So we've been exploring in this series, who is my neighbor? We started, of course, with the story of the Good Samaritan, wandered among with the demon-possessed man in Gerasa, in the Gospel of Luke. And last week, you were in Luke 15, which is one of my favorite texts of the Gospel of Luke. I always say that if Luke had one chapter's worth of papyrus, he gives us that little bit of Isaiah in chapter 4 when Jesus goes to the synagogue in Nazareth and reads from there. That's what he would give us. If he has just one chapter's worth of papyrus, I think he gives us the stories of Luke 15. Because the stories of Luke 15 are so much about the shape of the good news, about the shape of who we are. And I preached a little bit about that in January. So sorry I couldn't be here to talk more about that story. It's a fabulous story. One of the themes also we keep coming back to is the theme of vulnerability and the different kinds of vulnerabilities that we experience, that folks in these stories experience, and how that vulnerability shapes what it means to be a neighbor. So today we encounter a fabulous story in the book of Acts. It's a story about an Ethiopian eunuch and about Philip and their encounter in the middle of nowhere. It's a really striking story and one that I have all these like identity and narrative details for us to mess around with. So we'll have lots of fun with the story, I think, this morning. So the story starts like this. So this is Acts chapter 8, and the first person we meet is a man named Philip. So in order to get context for this, we have to think, well, where did this Philip guy come from? So all the way back in Acts chapter 6, you see a community in dispute. You see some community fighting happening. There's a group called the Hellenists. There's a group called the Hebrews in this early community. They're all Jews, but scholars kind of tend to lean to imagine that there are folks who, that the Hebrews are folks from the local area who speak primarily Hebrew, and the Hellenists are people from elsewhere in the ancient world, from the diaspora. So Jews who lived elsewhere maybe primarily speak Greek, but are now part of this emerging community of Jesus' followers. So there's a dispute among them, because the widows of the Hellenists are being shortchanged. So even in this community, where in chapter 4 it says there is not a needy person among them, and all of them shared their possessions, which we'll talk about next week, even in that community there are disputes. In the middle of that dispute, the disciples get together and basically say, we are too busy preaching and praying, we got to find somebody else to take care of the tables. And when I'm being really cynical, I think Luke is not happy about this decision, because they are putting forward preaching and praying and setting aside the waiting on tables, which is what Jesus does in Luke throughout the gospel. It's the most Jesus thing that he does. Anyway, they decide to do this. They cast lots, and they bring up 7 deacons. And among them is Philip. Philip had one job. That was to wait on tables. It's not what we're going to spot him doing in here in Acts chapter 8, starting in verse 26. So often the church tells us to do one thing, and the Spirit comes along and says, yes, keep doing that thing, but also this and that. And here, Philip is engaged in the this and that. So an angel of the Lord said to Philip, get up and go toward the south, to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a wilderness road. So when we hear wilderness road, our mind should be primed to think of one particular story in the Gospel of Luke, a story that we started this series with, the story of the Good Samaritan. So this is a terrible idea, to go to this road by himself, where we already heard a story about someone left for dead on the side of the road. Philip should say, well, let me go get some friends with me, let me go take my security team with me, but Philip just got up and went. There's this deep sense of faithfulness, of following Jesus, wherever Jesus will lead him, for Philip. So we meet Philip, and now we meet this Ethiopian eunuch who is unnamed, but nonetheless is described with this, these stacks of identity markers. Now, there was an Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of the Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, in charge of her entire treasury. They had come to Jerusalem to worship, and they were returning home. And seated in their chariot, they were reading the prophet Isaiah. So we run into this extraordinary person with this stack of descriptors. The first thing we learn about the Ethiopian eunuch is that they are from Ethiopia, which means they are African. They are dark-skinned. They are black-skinned. And here in the very pages of Scripture, without much fanfare, it's the expansive imagination of the hues of people that belong in this community. And it's so striking to me that so many generations of Christians missed the presence of the Ethiopian eunuch in this story. But second is that Ethiopia represents something particular in the ancient mind, especially in the ancient mind of folks living in the context of the Roman Empire. So, if I were to tell you that I am going to Newark Airport this afternoon, and I'm going to go get on a plane, and I'm going to the ends of the earth, where am I going?
Ethiopia.
I prepped you for this. Maybe not other than Ethiopia, where might I be going?
Siberia,
right? Middle of nowhere. Antarctica. Siberia. Timbuktu, right? Exotic, distant places, right? I said, no. Where I am going is London, or I'm going to Rome, or I'm going to Beijing. If you think back to the beginning of the book of Acts, Acts 1:8, Jesus says that you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Ethiopia, for a lot of people in the Greco-Roman Empire, represents that ends of the earth. So ancient historians and cartographers don't quite know where to put Ethiopia. It's either like south of Egypt or west of Libya. It's out there somewhere, some distant country. And the Ethiopians are kind of lifted up as an exotic, beautiful people. So here you have somebody coming from a great, great distance away. So we learned that they're Ethiopian, who've come an incredible distance away, and that they are a eunuch. And I love asking in church what that means, right? I won't make you say it. Okay, so this is a tradition in ancient royal courts where men would be castrated so that they could be trusted advisors to kings and to queens. Because they're so trusted, and because they're eunuchs, there would be no question about who the proper heir to the throne would be, if you catch my drift. Yeah? That's the idea. We don't do this in our politics, but sometimes you have to wonder. It might not be a good idea. So they're a eunuch. This is the end of the genetic line, the end of the line for them. A recent scholar, Margaret Amer, has suggested another layer to the Ethiopian eunuch's identity as well, is that the Ethiopian eunuch might also have been an enslaved person. Eunuchs often don't do this voluntarily. They're assigned to these duties, and that there's a layer here of enslavement, of control over this person's body. So they're an Ethiopian, they're a eunuch, they're a court official of the Candace, so incredibly powerful in this context. The Candace, who is the queen of the Ethiopians, and who is in charge of her entire treasury. Somebody who's every week. Do not disturb. There we go. So somebody who is incredibly powerful, we'll learn here in a second that they're incredibly educated as well, probably quite wealthy, traveled this long distance. And because they're a eunuch, in their coming to Jerusalem to worship, they are constrained by how close they can get to holy spaces. So there's a logic in the Hebrew scriptures about eunuchs that that folks who are have certain kinds of physical disabilities, maybe missing a limb, or in the case of eunuchs, are eunuchs, can only draw so close to holy spaces. So they travel these hundreds, maybe thousands of miles to get to Jerusalem to only get so close. They had come to Jerusalem to worship. They're returning home. They're seated in their chariot, which suggests, again, the wealth of the eunuch, because even in the ancient world, texting and driving is a terrible idea. So they're reading, so you need a driver. And they were reading the prophet Isaiah, which would also be a marker of their wealth. Because think about how much time someone had to invest in all of us so that we could just read something so easily as we do. And that literacy in the ancient world was quite rare as well. There's some debates about how do we count different kinds of literacy, but the kind of literacy where you can just sit there and read the scroll from Isaiah would have been probably quite rare in the world. So we have this incredible combination of identity markers, power and wealth and education, mixed with perhaps identity as an enslaved person, as a foreigner in this context, having come from a long distance away, and also because they can only draw so close to this temple where they come to worship. So in the Hebrew scriptures, eunuchs are known at first for how close they can draw to these holy spaces. But also in the book of Isaiah, they represent the widest embrace of belonging and inclusion. So when Isaiah imagines that all the nations of the world will come and worship together, at the very edges of that belonging are even eunuchs will be a part of this worship. But also then in texts like the Wisdom of Solomon, eunuchs are also reviled because they cannot bear children. They cannot have a generation beyond them. So we have this mixed narrative of eunuchs, whether they are the breadth of belonging or folks to continue to be reviled. And then the Spirit said to Philip, go over to this chariot and join it. Quite literally, glue yourself to this chariot. And then the scene is about to get weird and funny. So Philip ran up to it and heard them reading the prophet Isaiah. So here the Ethiopian eunuch is reading aloud, as many people do in the ancient world, not universally, but many people do. And he asked, do you understand what you are reading? And this is hilarious, because you have to imagine the scene, right? So the fancy golden chariot is clopping along at some brisk clip, and Philip, who probably doesn't run marathons in his free time, is running next to the chariot and asking breathlessly, not, excuse me, sir, do you understand what you are reading? But do you, he's breathless, understand? So it's a ridiculous scene in the middle of nowhere, made more ridiculous by the fact that we already know the Ethiopian eunuch is powerful, wealthy, educated. And we have to wonder whether Philip knows how to read, or that the Ethiopian eunuch can safely assume that this sweaty, breathless stranger that has shown up out of nowhere is not as literate, not as smart, not as powerful, not as wealthy as they are. Do you understand what you are reading? And it should be that the Ethiopian eunuch asks their driver to speed up and leave this sweaty guy in the middle of nowhere, leave him in the dust. But instead, they replied, how can I unless someone guides me? And people of wealth and education and of power, we're not used to asking for help from strangers in the middle of nowhere at noon, right? Especially some sweaty, breathless stranger in the middle of nowhere, right? We're not used to doing that, but here the eunuch asks for help. How can I unless someone guides me? I can't understand what I'm reading despite my wealth and my education without your help. And they invited Philip to get in to sit beside them. And this is what the eunuch was reading. The passage of the scripture that he was reading was this. This is from Isaiah. Like a sheep he was led to the slaughter, and like a lamb silent before its shearer, so he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken away from the earth. And the eunuch asked Philip a great question. About whom, may I ask, does the prophet say this? About himself or about someone else? And if you spent any time in the book of Acts, what we should have now is a long, extended speech. The book of Acts loves speeches. They are all over the book of Acts. course, Luke frustrates me and does not tell us how Philip answers this question. It does say that Philip begins to proclaim the good news to him, but what about this question? About whom, may I ask you, does the prophet say this, about himself or about someone else? I think we can answer this in many ways. Philip might say it is about himself, like the struggle of the prophet, pointing to the struggles of the people and identifying with them, right? So Isaiah here, when empires are threatening, thinking about Israel, thinking about himself as part of this larger community in this deep vulnerability that they are experiencing. But Philip could also give a second answer, and it's a Sunday school answer. Who is this about?
Jesus,
always the right answer, right? Because a sheep led to the slaughter, right? We can imagine that, like a lamb silent before its shearer, right? Jesus refusing to respond when he's being accused of all these things, so he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. He was innocent. This is something that Luke emphasizes over and over again in his own account of the cross, is that he should not have died in this way. He didn't do anything to deserve this. Justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? No one will come after him, for his life is taken away from the earth. So we can imagine a beautiful sermon that Philip gave. But this is not just about Isaiah. It's about Jesus, too. But I think there's a third option, and I think it's a more powerful option. Is that it's about Isaiah. It's about Jesus, Philip says. But it's also about you. Like a sheep, he was led to the slaughter, and like a lamb silent before its shearer. Now, we imagine that the reason the Ethiopian eunuch dwells on this passage is that it brings memories to him of his own, of their own experiences. So he does not open his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him, and in his enslavement, in his being made a eunuch, and the ways that although they have all this power and all this wealth and education, people always look at them sideways. They can only get so close to the temple. Who can describe his generation? No one will come after them to tell their story. For his life is taken away from the earth. When the eunuch dies, that's the end of their story. No one will come after them. I wonder if what part of what Philip does here is to say to the eunuch, because this passage is about Jesus, it's also about you. And because it's about you, it's also about Jesus. And I wonder if Philip knew that before he met the eunuch. If he'd read that text before, maybe outside of that context, without being in front of this Ethiopian eunuch, would he have said, oh, this is about Jesus? And did it take this encounter with this stranger from a far distant country to realize this text is not just about Jesus? It's also about someone like this Ethiopian eunuch. As they were going along the road, because we skip right over, because Luke doesn't tell us what Philip said, but we can imagine. They're going along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, look, here is water. What is to prevent me from being baptized? And I can think of a whole list of reasons that the eunuch shouldn't be baptized. They're a foreigner, they're wealthy and powerful, and sometimes Luke is kind of sideways with the wealth of the world. But most of all is, and there's some scholarly debate about this, about whether the Ethiopian eunuch is, in Luke's mind, is a Jew or a Gentile. And I think there's good reason to imagine that this eunuch is a Gentile in Luke's eyes. And if so, no Gentile has been baptized up to this point. It's all Judeans, all Jews up to this point. Remember in Acts chapter 10, that whole story with Peter and Cornelius? That's the one that draws the attention of the church. That's the one that they create a whole committee to figure out what happened. Here, this shouldn't be happening. And it hasn't happened yet. And not only that, is that we're not dealing with one of the stars of the book of Acts. So it's not Peter, it's not Paul, it's Philip. Philip's going to disappear from the scene here, maybe show up later with seven prophesying daughters, if it's the same Philip, but we're not quite sure. But this is like going to a movie and you think you're signing up to see George Clooney, but you're stuck with Adam Sandler. Like, it's not, he's not one of the stars of the movie. Why Philip? There's all sorts of reasons that would prevent the Ethiopian eunuch from being baptized. And yet, the eunuch commanded the chariot to stop, and both of them, Philip and the eunuch, went down into the water, and Philip baptized them. One of the features of the Greek here that's really striking is that it says, and he baptized him. And from context and grammar, it probably means that Philip baptized the eunuch. But I can't help but imagine that this moment is not just something that Philip does for the eunuch. But is there stuff happening here that the eunuch is doing for Philip? That in this baptism, it's this mutual recognition, this mutual imagination about belonging and about neighborliness that they're experiencing in those waters. The Spirit answers the question that in the middle of nowhere, in an arid place, there's water. So the eunuch asks, what does prevent me from being baptized? Not even that. Not even being in the middle of nowhere, not being with Philip, not your identity as a eunuch or as an Ethiopian or as a rich person, a wealthy person, an enslaved person. None of that is a barrier to your belonging here. And God's going to make that clear by having enough water for two grown people to get into and do baptism. I'm a Baptist. To do baptism the right way. This isn't like a little puddle for sprinkling. We're full immersion. We're doing it all the way. Just kidding. When they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord snatched Philip away. The eunuch saw him no more and went on their way rejoicing. But Philip found himself at Azotus, and as he was passing through the region, he proclaimed the good news to all the towns until he came to Caesarea. I was in my first semester of seminary. I was in a class that Beverly Gaventa was teaching on the book of Acts. And one of my classmates, we were reading the story, and it's like, yeah, it's like Philip had a really crazy night in Tijuana and woke up with a new tattoo. Like, that was the experience here. I think that story was cited in the commentary that Beverly wrote, which I take pride that I was there. But I love this ending. So when he comes out of the water, the work is done, and Philip disappears. The eunuch saw him no more. Apparently no one is fazed by this whole experience. But the eunuch goes on their way rejoicing. Where do they go? They go back to Ethiopia. What did we say at the beginning? Ethiopia is the ends of the earth, Timbuktu. So think again, Acts 1:8, Jesus says, you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And what if the Ethiopian eunuch, all the way in chapter 8, takes the good news to the ends of the earth, and no one notices? The church has no idea, because they just go on their way rejoicing. And what if this magnificent scene of a Gentile being baptized happens, and the church simply doesn't notice? One of the things I love about the book of Acts is that it doesn't narrate everything. It's always stuff happening in the background. It's as if God's activity is the background static of the narrative. So when Paul gets to Rome at the end of the book of Acts, there are fellow Jesus followers there to help him. Where did they come from? Paul hasn't been to Rome before. He didn't found a church there. Where did they come from? It happened in the background. And this is one example of the background static of God's activity in the book of Acts. It's a great story. It's not the full story. I don't know if you notice, for those of you who read in your small groups this week, what is to prevent me from being baptized is in verse 36. Chapter 8, verse 36. And what number comes after 36? Trick question. Should be 37, but it jumps right to this. This is verse 38. They commanded the chariot to stop. So if you go back to your study Bibles, there's a little footnote, and we're going to get super nerdy here for a little bit. In the footnote, it will say this. Other ancient authorities add all or most of verse 37. So not in the main text. It goes from 36 to 38. And this is in the footnote. And Philip said, if you believe with all your heart, you may. And they replied, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. what happened here. As you probably know, when it comes to the manuscripts of the New Testament, there are thousands of them. Not two of them are exactly alike. A lot of the differences between the manuscripts are totally explainable. There's spelling mistakes. There are moments when there might be a room full of scribes listening to someone read the text, and they're copying what they're hearing. And so, like, some person reads one thing, but they hear something quite similar, but not quite the right thing. Right? This happens to us. Or have you ever done this when you're reading? Like, you're reading a paragraph, you look away, and you come back, and you find the same words, but they're, like, three or four lines down. Sometimes there's three or four lines missing because they can tell the scribe went and looked and saw they said, wrote they said, and their eyes went further down, and they missed those three to four. So sometimes the mistakes are totally, or the differences are totally explainable. The oldest and best manuscripts of the book of Acts do not have these words. And if you think about it, the story reads better without them. This is an intrusion. What is to prevent me from being baptized? Boom, water, we're done. But what happened is that some scribe, somebody in the church, somebody helping transmit these texts decided, whoa, there is one thing that prevents you from being baptized. The eunuch never confessed. The eunuch didn't say the right words. As we said in my Southern Baptist tradition growing up, the eunuch didn't walk down the aisle and accept Jesus as their Lord and Savior. And so somebody added verse 37 with Philip asking, saying, if you believe with all your heart, you may. And the eunuch replying with a confession. It ruins the story, right? The immediacy of the answer. But somebody said, no, there's one thing that's missing. And it makes me wonder if there are ways that we create verse 37s around our own communities. Where God has made a way in, we have created restrictions to belonging, to neighborliness. And there are churches in this country where people literally would stand at the door and tell certain people they were welcome and they were not. And that doesn't happen quite as much anymore, but I go to a lot of churches, and often the sign at the front will say everyone is welcome, but there should be an asterisk next to those in a lot of places. Maybe some of the places we know where everyone is welcome as long as you look like us. Everyone is welcome as long as you can talk the talk like we can. Everyone is welcome, but don't try to change us too much. Don't try to change the color of the carpet. Don't try to change the way that we do things. And we create these boundaries of belonging. Who is my neighbor? I think there's a couple ways that we might think about that question in light of this story. We might think about Philip's bold proclamation. So it starts at the beginning of the story with the Spirit telling, the angel of the Lord telling Philip to do this silly, ridiculous, dangerous thing. And that Philip does it right away. And that way Philip looks like the Samaritan, right? Willing to put his life in danger, willing to go into vulnerable spaces, willing to reach out to this person who he doesn't know, but to try to reach them with the good news, whether it's delivering them from death, or here, perhaps in the case of the eunuch, delivering them from this existential anxiety that their life doesn't have much meaning. They have that encounter. But maybe it's not just about Philip. Maybe it's about the eunuch as well, and the way the eunuch is a neighbor to Philip, helping Philip expand his own imagination for who is covered by the good news of Jesus. What if the eunuch is not the only person who leaves this scene changed and transformed? What if Philip needed the Ethiopian eunuch too? What if Philip needed to encounter this extraordinary person in the middle of nowhere, and Philip's life is changed by that encounter? One of the difficulties, I think, going back to that Good Samaritan story and the ways that we often read that text is that we imagine ourselves as a Samaritan helping others. More rarely, as we talked about, do we imagine ourselves as the person in need of delivering, of delivery, of salvation. And here, we'd rather imagine ourselves as Philip, bringing the good news to the stranger in the middle of nowhere, proclaiming Jesus to them, and then heading out on our way. But part of the vulnerability that Philip encountered on that road is not just that he might end up beat up and left for dead on the side of the road, is that he might encounter someone whose story would change him, whose story would make him think differently about the world, whose story would make him think differently about Jesus. Maybe Philip did not know that Jesus looks like an Ethiopian eunuch until he met them in the middle of nowhere. To me, it also is a reminder that our neighbors have long and complex stories that we can't always see. That maybe when people saw the Ethiopian eunuch in their fancy chariot, they would make assumptions about the kind of comfortable life they were leading. What if their life is more complex, harder than we can imagine? And last, that what makes our neighbors is that Jesus has already moved in their lives. The story suggests to me that the Ethiopian eunuch is not reading the text of Isaiah by accident. That Jesus is already moving in their life, in their deepest worries, and bringing this text to them and bringing Philip to them to encounter the possibilities that they belong, that they matter, that their life matters to God. And so often what we do when we're meeting new neighbors is not bringing Jesus to them at all, but helping us all name the ways that Jesus is moving in their lives and in our lives in ways usually we did not expect, we did not anticipate, but can transform us. So neighborliness maybe isn't just about being nice, but about that risky proposition that someone else's story will change how we see the world. And that maybe is the biggest risk that we take in these encounters. Questions, thoughts on this funny, weird little story? I think Holly has the microphone so we can capture your brilliant ideas on tape in the front.
Thank you so much. This is not a question, but I'm reflecting on what you said. I have to confess that when I read it, and Philip asked the eunuch, do you understand what you're reading? Yeah. I imagined Philip sort of looking down on the eunuch, that I'm the Christian, do you even understand this? But from what you say, Philip probably was going, wow, he's reading. Mm-hmm. Maybe he can teach me something. Mm-hmm. And maybe the eunuch was saying, huh, he's talking about it. Maybe let's talk about this. I hadn't looked at that at all. I had the positions reversed.
Well, too, and to think about the literal physical positions, like the eunuch high on a chariot, Philip low running beside. And I had not thought, actually, this is really helpful. How real of a question is, do you understand what you are reading? Is it like, wink, wink, you don't understand what you are reading,
that's
do you?
I
think that's what I was still assuming, but I think this is helpful. Like, is that a real question that Philip is saying? Do you understand what you are reading? Because maybe Philip is hearing the eunuch reading and thinks, I think this is about Jesus, but is there something else happening here too? Huh. Is it a real, what if it is a real question that Philip is asking? Do you understand what you are reading? Because maybe the two of them cannot understand what they are reading until they read it together. Mm-hmm. That they need each other to understand mm-hmm. this text. Brilliant. I love it. This is why I love doing this, because I learn new stuff all the time. I've read this text a million times, and I had not thought about that. I love that. Thank you.
Good morning. I was really relieved and happy when you said this might be a parable rather than a recounting of something that's supposed to have actually happened. It makes so much more sense to me if you regard it as a parable in which there is no backstory, in which you really don't have to analyze this, just look at it at face value. Yeah. Is there any scholarship regarding that?
So I think Luke imagines it, that it's a thing that happened. But I also think that when Luke is not just interested in telling the story as it happened, right? He's a historian, sort of. But his interest is more in how these stories form communities. So the fact, I think Luke thinks that this story happened, the fact that it happened, however, is not the most important thing to Luke. What's most important to him is, what does this story tell us about the Spirit, about who God is, about how God is moving? So in that way, it becomes parabolic, at least, even if it's not in the form of a parable. Because these stories aren't just, there's not a test at the end where what are the dates of these events, right? It's not like old traditional history. But it's more about how do these stories form us and shape us? How do they shape our imagination? So I think in that way, it's another way of approaching the story. So it's less, I always say this about the story, and with the book of Acts, that so often we read the book of Acts like an instruction manual for putting together the perfect church. And if that's the case, then I don't know what to do with the story, because I'm not going to get a text from Jesus this afternoon telling me to go find an Ethiopian eunuch on 206 somewhere. So it's not about what do you do when you meet a eunuch on a chariot in the middle of nowhere, but it is the story about these chance encounters that God has concocted, God has nurtured, and how we might enter those moments with expectation, and knowing full well the risk that we are taking, that when we encounter, maybe it's not a eunuch, but it's some other stranger, that their story is going to change how we think about Jesus. And I think that in that way, it's a parable, right? It's a story that says more than just what happened at a certain point in history.
I'm also thinking about it as a way to bring the story beyond Jerusalem before Paul.
Yep.
We give Paul a lot of credit for spreading the beginning churches all over. But this predates all that. And that...
Yes, Paul is still Saul, right? He's still persecuting people.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's whether it happened this way or not, it's a way to move that piece of the church along.
And to that, it's that often in church, our eyes are turned towards the heroes, to the big actors, and maybe acts as a reminder that we shouldn't just look to people at pulpits or podiums to look for what God is doing, to look into each and every one of our lives and the people on the margins of our existence, that often is where the Spirit is most living and active. I think often we tend to look up, and maybe we need to look sideways and around the corner to see where the Spirit is acting and living. So, yeah, I love that connection.
You just mentioned that these are chance encounters. To me, the difference in this one, this was not a chance
That's
encounter.
True. This is true, yeah.
This is the one where the Holy Spirit said, go
sets
do this.
Sets us up, yeah. Yep.
It wasn't like I see this guy at the side of the road.
Yeah.
Do you attach any significance to that?
Yeah, and I wonder, so this is, as soon as I said chance encounter, I was like, that's not quite right. But I knew somebody would call me on it, so that's good. So I think you're exactly right about the story. There's this sense of like orchestration. The Spirit sends Philip, the eunuch happens to be there, it's all set up. And often these stories are happening this way. But I wonder if for Philip, the Spirit's hand is only evident in retrospect, right? So we're reading the story in retrospect. And I know I've had these moments in my own life that you look back and you're like, oh my goodness, I was so courageous. And then you think about it, you're like, no, there's something else happening here. And I wonder if that's the case for Philip as well. Maybe as he's telling the story, he's imagining, oh, this was the Spirit's activity, even though maybe in the moment it feels like a chance encounter. And I wonder if that happens in our lives as well. Like these moments when we're not even paying attention, we don't notice and something happens. And there's these new opportunities to share in the good news that maybe it's in retrospect we realize, oh, it's the Spirit's movement. It's the Spirit's moving. So maybe somewhere in between. Not quite a chance encounter, but I wonder if for Philip it felt like a chance encounter in the moment. And then in retrospect, oh, something else is happening here. Here in the back.
I was just going to note, too, that
please.
We don't have a sense from the Ethiopian eunuch. Like, this was totally a chance encounter for him.
The eunuch,
we don't know what his, if he felt, called in a particular way. Yeah. But I could imagine that it felt very chance-like. What is this person doing?
What is this sweaty, breathless person doing here? Yeah. I love that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I wonder if you attach any significance to the words that are ascribed to the Spirit. The rise and go, and then the go over and join. So it's not teach or or preach or tell. Yeah. It's join.
Join.
Go over and join.
Yeah, I love that. So I think here it's not described what he is to do when he gets there. It's just to go. And I love this, right? Go over to this chariot and draw near to it. Join yourself to it. And not just to the chariot, but to the story of the person inhabiting that chariot. That there's something about proximity. So maybe that's another theme that we've seen throughout, is that vulnerability requires proximity. And maybe the boldest step that Philip takes is that step of proximity, right? When all these boundaries, all these barriers should be between them, is to draw near. So I love that. I think there is good significance to draw there. I think there's a question up here in the front. And then Marshall after that, I think.
Wonderful explanation, and thank you. I'm grappling with the end of the story, where it seems to me that for Philip, it says he continues to spread the word. The eunuch disappears. And why is it that Philip is removed completely?
Yeah, it's weird.
They don't have a story together.
Yeah. You know? They go on the road like they're like doing a show together.
So it's a strange ending.
Yeah, it is a strange ending. Also, because Philip just disappears from the narrative. We don't really hear from him unless he is the same Philip with the seven prophesying daughters later. And the eunuch, we never hear anything from again, not even remotely. I wonder if this part of the narrative where the Spirit of the Lord snatched Philip away is a framing. So it starts by the Spirit's... the encounter starts because the Spirit tells Philip to go, and when it's over, then the Spirit takes him away. It adds to the sense of the scene, that this is the Spirit's activity. The Spirit decides when Philip goes, also when he leaves. So it maybe is a lesson in that way. But I do think that they don't just go on their way. They go on their way rejoicing. And I wonder if that contains, there's like a whole set of stories contained within that rejoicing of them telling the story, but then them also experiencing life in quite a very different way. And I think Luke does this often with these stories. So whether it's the story of Zacchaeus or the story of the Gerasene demoniac or the former Gerasene demoniac, we don't know what happened when Jesus left. And in this case, we don't know what happens when they go on their way rejoicing. And maybe that's part of the imaginative invitation of these stories. What is their life like after this? We have these, in our case, often seemingly chance encounters that maybe are divine encounters. We don't often know how the story unfurls later for these people. Maybe that's part of the gamble of faith, is that we encounter people, we do our best to love them, to share the good news, not knowing how their lives will unfurl after that encounter. I think the last comment, I think.
Yeah, that it was. You sort of answered my question. Right. The snatched, was that a supernatural sort of thing?
Yeah, I think so. It's this verb harpazo. weirdly, so when people, have you ever heard people talk about the rapture? It's that verb. So it's not, so that's where they get it. And then in 1 Thessalonians, anyway, that's a whole other thing. But I think it is this kind of supernatural, like it just happens all of a sudden. Like it's, he gets beamed up. What are some other sci-fi things? He just disappears. Like, I think it adds to this element that this story seems almost fantastical, and maybe is like bringing us to the level of the parable, because you wonder, wait, did this just really happen? And maybe Philip, as he's snatched away, Philip is wondering, did I just talk to an Ethiopian eunuch in a fancy golden chariot? Did that really just happen? So I think it adds to those elements of the story. Dr. Stuckey, you get the last word.
I'm just going to go shamelessly on brand here and wonder if
it.
You can
yes.
do a little bit of an ecological
good
read yeah. here. And you know, it's interesting to me that it's the wilderness road, but I wonder if the water is irrelevant. Oh. I mean, I suspect that it's not.
Yeah.
But I think it's easy to read it and like...
skim over.
The fact that there is water on this wilderness road, which you lifted up.
Yeah.
But that's a special kind of joining to go into the water with someone.
Yeah. That's good.
And somehow water and spirit and the two of these together, I wonder if this is the moment the eunuch feels joined. And maybe Philip too. And the response is the spirit snatches Philip away and the eunuch is rejoicing. So I just to say, maybe there's more going on with the water than we typically recognize.
I love that. What I just imagined, yeah, was this moment of joy when Philip baptizes the eunuch. And maybe Philip experiences this moment of joining as well, and that for him is also transformative. And he's snatched away, and like, but the end of the story is the eunuch splashing in the waters in joy. And Philip's gone, but all that's left is joy. So I love that. Thank you, friends. Next week, we will continue in the book of Acts, read the story of Ananias and Sapphira. What are we doing? Who picked these texts? Oh, I did. Okay. All right, we'll see you next week.